Hey, welcome to another week of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. I probably sounded more excited than I should have there. My name's Lauren Fox.
And I'm Andrew Hansen.
And I guess we are excited. It's Friday. It's Memorial Day weekend, where we, of course, take the time to remember and respect those who have paid the ultimate sacrifice to our country. So, of course, thank you for that. But it's also, if you look at it, and we keep tending to overstate this, it's like another sports weekend epicenter of all the things, this black hole vortex of a million things going on all at the same time.
Oh, so much. So much good stuff. We've got the Stanley Cup Finals set.
Yes.
We've got...
I was very happy to see Ovechkin get his way into the finals. You hate to ever have a guy who's had a career as storied as his is missing that mark. There are some guys who can pull it off. Ernie Banks is the first one I think of who never won a World Series, never got to a World Series, but he was Mr. Cub. He was the centerpiece of a franchise that was lovable losers. Ovechkin's team was every year they were at the top of the conference and just couldn't find a way to get it done. And looks like this is their year, but the real story is you have them. That's okay. Are they going to get one for him versus Vegas, the expansion team that overcame an insane amount of tragedy basically before they even played a game? They've been together for, what, 240 days, give or take. They're four wins away.
Yeah, the clash of two amazing stories that people can get behind. And you're right, it's a great story for Ovechkin. And game seven this week against Tampa, you know, he made his mark. He scored just over a minute into game seven with a beautiful slap shot. So he puts them up 1-0. They end up winning the game 4-0. So he has the game-winning goal and really just coming up clutch. What a great moment for him. And then Vegas, an expansion team getting to the finals in their first year. It's never been done before for an expansion team to win a championship in year one. And it's going to be fun.
As my resident hockey expert, Jason Bergeron, said, though, the reason that Vegas has an advantage as an expansion team is look at the experience of those guys. They don't have any guys that they're bringing in who are callow. These guys are veterans with a backstop like Marc-Andre Fleury, who was with the Pens and won, what, three NHL titles. Or Stanley Cups, as the hockey people refer to them. You look at that, the level of experience that team has. Expansion teams usually don't get goalies like Fleury backing things up.
Yeah, he's been the key. And I heard just a quick snippet about the selection process that Vegas had. I think it was that each team got to protect eight players. So they obviously... they couldn't pluck a star from another team. That's never how it works,
right,
with expansion drafts. But I'd like to dig and see if I can find a synopsis of what went into their player selection and how much of it was chemistry. Because they're obviously picking guys that, you know, they're not on the first line, but they sure can come together. And you're right, they obviously had enough experience that, you know, they just, when you put them together in Vegas, everything just clicked.
Right. So that was not on the list that we were going to talk about hockey. It just kind of happened. It's your fault. But baseball, we're in the middle of baseball season. Are the baseballs or are they not aerodynamically favoring the hitters was the question. And they have said, yes, they are. I don't know what that does to anybody's ERA. And then I think the Houston Astros or anybody who has faced the Houston Astros would tend to disagree with that.
Yeah, their starting rotation has been dominant. Right, and so that's a little bit confusing to me because the pitchers, there have been all these articles about how many pitches have been thrown at 98 miles per hour plus this season, you know, more than ever. And so there are these power pitchers that are tallying up extreme levels and amounts of strikeouts.
Right.
And on the flip side, you've got hitters swinging for the fences, changing the launch angle, and hitting bunches of home runs. So it's playing out as a slightly different game than in years past.
It's turned into kind of a weird game. It has changed, and quickly, with the shifts, with stolen bases becoming less and less of a factor, with speed on the bases becoming less of a factor, because if you have a guy who hits a home run behind you, it doesn't matter how fast you are, how slow you are. But then the three true outcome hitters, the Adam Dunns of the world, who if it's a strikeout, a walk, or a home run, that's what we expect. At least we stayed out of the double play.
Exactly, exactly. Guys seeing a lot of pitches. And as things change naturally from that perspective, one of the changes that the Tampa Bay Rays have made recently is very exciting.
It's weird, but it's fun.
Yeah, that's what
I
think.
And it's not ruining the game in spite of what some people will say.
Exactly, exactly. And so it's just kind of funny because when we broadcast the Bedford High School baseball game a couple weeks ago and we did our little trivia back and forth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was, yeah.
The Sergio Romo was the answer.
Brawley, California.
The guy that I couldn't get him out of my head for about two innings.
The after Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So finally we got his name. And then sure enough, he pops up a couple weeks later because he, as a lifetime reliever, makes his first start in the major leagues, pitches an inning, and then turns around and starts the next game and pitches two. And what the Rays are doing is they're experimenting a little bit by having a reliever start the game to deal with the top three or four hitters. Then you put in the quote-unquote starter, who's traditionally going to pitch 6 to 7 innings. Then he's facing those top hitters on their second and third at bat, and so far it's working pretty well. You know, the Rays have had some injuries, and what I want to see is, does this gain any traction? You know, anytime you start something new, people are going to frown upon it and be scared of it, but I think there's a lot to be said for it. I mean, it's why a lot of the teams now only ask their starter to go 5 or 6 innings, because they built up these, you know, extremely talented bullpens who have three guys that can come out and shut you down in innings 7, 8, and 9. Well, why not, if you can get four of those relievers, you know, have one start the game, then have your starter go as long as he's producing, and then you've got, you know, two or three arms that are going to come in and close it up.
You know, it's funny because guys are always going to say things like, this is ruining the game. And in this case, it was the Angels third baseman, Zach Cozart, who says, this is weird, it's bad for the game. But the reason he doesn't like it is because he was the first one to strike out. Mike Trout was the second. Justin Upton was the third. So, of course, he's not going to like it. Not to mention, it's a weird look. And relief pitchers are different from starters in that they typically don't have a full arsenal of pitches. You're talking fastball, maybe some kind of off-speed pitch. And that's really the reason that Dennis Eckersley was so effective late in his career, is he went from being a starter with a full array of pitches to the bullpen with that same full array of pitches for one inning and just empty the tank in one inning. But it's always the tendency of guys, like you said, this is weird, this is bad. Well, if he hadn't struck out, if he had hit a leadoff nuke, my new favorite term, if he had hit a leadoff bomb, he wouldn't be complaining about it. He's mad about it because it worked. And there's sometimes that I look at a manager, and I hate to say this, you read the Sports Illustrated preview profile of Gabe Kapler, who's the manager of the Phillies, and you look at that guy and you say, here's a guy who is really trying to show everybody how smart he is, and I'm so smart, and I'm doing all these things that are well thought out, which, if you're the smartest guy in the room, you should probably find another room. I think I've probably said that in here before.
No, I've never heard that.
Yeah. Kevin Cash is doing this because he thinks it's sound baseball strategy. It's not cute. It's an experiment. Nobody really thought the Rays were going to set the world on fire this year, so it's fun and interesting to see.
Yeah, and they're 23-25, which in the AL East puts them 10 games back of the Red Sox. The Red Sox have the best record in Major League Baseball.
Still. Well, but that's what happens when you start out 17-2, by the way.
That helps.
Yeah. But I mean, well, you could start out 17-2 and play 500 ball for the rest of the way, and you're still going to be what? You're still going to win 88 games?
Right. And you're likely in the playoffs.
Right.
The Rays, if they were in the AL Central, they would be one game out of first place.
Right.
So they just find themselves in a tough division, but they're still, you know, they're basically 500. They're trying to make a push. And I think it really does add a level of challenge to the hitters because, you know, Cozart is talking about, well, it's like spring training because you just guys go out and pitch 1 or 2 innings. So every time you go up, you're facing a new pitcher. That's a challenge that a hitter doesn't really want to face.
No.
They want to get up there and see a guy, see what he looks like on that day, and adjust for the second and third at bat. And
it's different.
Yeah.
And that's precisely why it works. And we'll talk to Rick Muntean, the general manager of the Silver Knights down in Nashua later, who's been a baseball guy for 1,000 years, but he and I worked with a guy named Dirty Al Gallagher, who Dirty Al used to throw Isla Borders, who is, to my recollection, the only female to ever play professional baseball, not in a women's league, in a primarily men's league. He would throw Isla Borders for the first 9 batters of the game at topping out at 81, 82, mixing in curveballs. Go through the first 9, guys would be on their front foot making lousy swings, and then he'd bring in a guy throwing 92, 93, who seemed like he was throwing 110.
Right.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
Like, you can't legislate it out of the game, because what if you were going to take your starter and have him go through 9? That's it.
Right, right. Well, it's funny. You and I haven't ever talked about this, but when I was in San Angelo, Texas, for a while, I had a teammate who was a woman who played second base.
That's right. Her husband was on the team.
He played third base.
Yes.
And I was on first.
Yeah. That's right.
That was fun.
Yeah. Yeah. They give each other kisses as they were going out to positions.
Probably no, not. They didn't.
I do they remember did. That, though. Yeah.
Yeah. She was solid, you know, another player for Maggie to look up to. I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. You know, she was just very fundamentally sound, so she could field her position well at second. She didn't have great power hitting, but you could tell she was she'd always been a great player.
Right.
Great success.
You have to be a complete dirt dog to get to that level.
Yep.
And I don't want anybody to get offended about the kissing each other on the field, the husband and wife. That's what my wife and I would do. It would drive everybody nuts. We were down at Holman last night for a baseball game, which is where we ran into Rick, for an old man baseball game, and I came strolling off the field when she came walking up and gave her a kiss and a big hug, and Rick happened to be up in the Silver Knights office and just starts hooting and hollering at the two of us.
Well, was that after your first at-bat or your second?
It was after my first at-bat. No,
okay.
First at-bat was bad.
So she was cheering you up, and then you went out and got a hit in your second at-bat.
I went out and got a hit in my second at-bat and tried to stretch it into a double, and was told that however fast you think you are, divide it in half, and that's your actual speed, so... Anyway, all right. So we wanted to give a quick update on Tim Tebow too.
Yeah, because if you talk about experiments and
yes.
doing things differently, that's another category where a lot of guys just shake their head and say, "Oh, he doesn't deserve a spot. What is this, a circus show?" But he's been a solid player,
right?
You know, his average this year is 242, but he has 4 home runs, 18 RBIs. And he actually is one of those guys where it's basically boom or bust. You know, he has 61 strikeouts and 128 at bats.
Yikes.
But, 11 extra base hits. So he is exceeding the expectations of many.
Me included.
And one of the stats not really a stat, but something that jumped out at me that I hadn't really thought about is he's actually the oldest batter in the Eastern League.
Yeah, I saw that in that article that you sent over.
Right.
That's got to be a bit of pressure. The fact that he's going into stadiums, and we talked to Mike Ramshaw and talked to Jeff Taliaferro at the Fisher Cats, the scene that he walks into and the people that show up who might not ordinarily show up for a game, that is a different environment entirely. When Tim Tebow walks in, and he's got to deal with that, but it's nothing that he's not used to. The other weird thing, if you're looking at the Binghamton Rumble Pony stats, that doesn't roll off the tongue like the Binghamton Mets used to. Their center fielder has attempted 5 stolen bases and has been thrown out all 5 times.
John Mora.
Yes. I found that to be an interesting stat.
.235 batting average.
Yes. Yeah.
Not the right combination for a center fielder.
No.
If you're not going to bat over .250, you need to be able to steal some
bases.
You
got to be able to pick up some bags. So, yeah, Tim Tebow, it will be interesting to see, and you would have to figure that if the Mets don't, and the National League East has been very surprising. The Braves, the Phillies, the Nationals, everybody I think thought was going to do it. Everybody's still waiting for the Braves and the Phillies to come back to Earth, which I would figure will happen by July, but the Braves have some really fun young players. Acuna Jr. and
Albies,
Ozzie Albies. But with that group, they could have some staying power. The Phillies could too, as much as it drives me nuts with Herrera and Michael Franco. It's just some interesting teams and some managers who walked into a rebuilding process kind of at the right time.
Yeah. Yep. It's a fun time as the baseball season gets going here. Most teams have played about 50 games. We've also got the Major League Baseball draft coming up.
Yep.
And which makes me think, you know, you mentioned the Nukes.
Yeah.
You've got to wonder what's going to happen with LSU's
new hitter.
New hitter, new phenom. You know, does he have a shot to get drafted? You found a story that really caught your eye.
Oh, I love that. It was last night, so this is Friday when we're taping. LSU batted their pitcher, and the coach of LSU, Paul Maneri, asked the pitcher, Todd Peterson, can you hit? And he said, yeah, I can hit. I hit in high school. Okay, great. Coach sends him up to hit and basically says, take three strikes and come back to the dugout. And what does the dude do? He cranks a line drive off the left field wall and winds up on second base flexing. And then
Knocks in two.
And then after the game in the press conference, the coach asks him, hey, somehow it comes up, hey, do you hit in high school? He says, well, I kind of lied to you, coach. I didn't hit in high school. I hit BP in high school. And the coach, you told me you hit Nukes. I told you I hit Nukes. I hit Nukes in BP.
That's
to
right.
which, of course, they're talking on ESPN this morning. Jalen Rose says, how does the coach not know his own players? In all fairness, he's got a roster of 30-something players. It's hard to remember. If a guy's a pitcher, great. But unless he's primarily a two-way guy, you've kind of put that out of your head for the most part. There are some guys over the years who have been in college, the Mark Kotze from Cal State Fullerton of the world. But for the most part, once guys are in college, it's you're a position player or you're a pitcher. That's it.
Yeah. It's
Brooks Kieschnick.
Yeah.
There's a good one.
Yeah, it's funny how that played out. Because what happened was they'd lost their designated hitter that game, and this was a reliever who they wanted to keep in the game. It was a one-run game.
Yeah.
And so, of course, the coach is saying, don't swing so you don't get hurt because we want you to go out and pitch.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, he makes it a three-run lead, and a star is born, and he really had fun with that post-game press conference.
They all did, and that's college baseball, and that's you just want to see that. You also had in that old Ole Miss game, runners on second and third, and a comebacker to the pitcher. Did you see this?
No.
Comebacker to the pitcher with two outs, runners on second and third. He throws home. What's wrong with this picture?
Uh-oh.
He doesn't just throw home. He airmails his catcher by a good 4 or 5 feet.
Oh,
like, even if the bases were loaded, it would have been, oh, my God, what just happened here? Airmails the catcher. The runner from third scores easily. The runner from second is about 4 feet behind him because he's really going on contact. And they both score, and Ole Miss winds up winning in extra innings with that guy on the mound. They win via walk-off. Oh, yeah. It's with all this playoff softball, I don't know if you saw this, the shortstop for Texas A&M, two errors in the bottom of the seventh, the bases wind up loaded, then two walks, and they lose by way of two bases loaded walks.
Ouch.
Yeah. Yeah, we watch way too much sports.
Yeah. The LSU pitcher, though, it just says a lot about confidence and the mental impact on performance. I mean, imagine if he'd gone up there like most pitchers probably would, thinking, yeah, I'm not going to swing. I'm not a hitter. But instead, he's talking to himself and his coach about hitting nukes.
Yeah.
And he goes up and lines one off the wall.
It goes back to the peak performance stuff of, I don't know what he was thinking about, obviously, because I'm not in his brain, but I'm willing to bet there's no pressure. He's not thinking about what's anybody going to think of me if I strike out. He's not thinking about the situation, anything like that. All he's thinking is, I want to swing, see the ball, hit the ball.
Yeah.
That's it. It is in its simplest form. So, I don't know. It's fun, and it's fun for these kids to have the opportunity to get to do that. I loved watching that post-game press conference, like the back and forth between him and the coach. So Yeah, with that, it is to be a sports fan. We're cranking into summer. It is the high point of the, and we will talk about the NBA because we always do. That the NHL Stanley Cup playoffs, the Bedford Men's Basketball League finals are down the road. We are not going to talk about that. And
tickets are on sale now, though.
Tickets are on sale now. So we'll be back after this. We're going to be joined by Nashua Silver Knights General Manager Rick Muntean. You're listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Joined here by a special guest, and I guess I should reintroduce the segment. You're listening to Fox on Sports here on Bedford 105.1, Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen. And yes, we have a special guest that we're having some colorful on-air conversation with. Old friend who I used to wander the halls of Community America Ballpark in Kansas City, Kansas with. He was the general manager of the T-Bones in the Independent Northern League back then. Now he's here as the general manager of the Nashua Silver Knights, Rick Muntean. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, and in your honor, Mr. Fox, I've got my T-Bones, one of my only pieces of T-Bones memorabilia on.
You know, I have one of those sweet staff shirts. It's actually still in my closet, but I think I may be banned from wearing it because it's been washed too many times.
and it
doesn't
cotton,
fit.
Right?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Nobody wears cotton anymore. So, yeah, those. I have a couple of those. They're retired permanently.
Yeah, those were nice. So the Futures League and the Silver Knights are coming off a 2017 Futures League championship. For people who haven't been to a game, what can they expect to see?
Well, you know what, Lauren? I mean, it's a minor league baseball game, only it's just called the Summer College League level. So if you've been to a minor league baseball game, you're going to see everything that you see at one of those events. So we do all of the promotions, and we have, you know, several promotions every night. We play a 28-game home schedule, 56 total, and the players are in college. And I got to tell you, Lo, I mean, I've been a GM at every level, and I like this level the best, and here's why. And this is what you'll see in a summer college game. They catch the ball. They can hit. They hit for power. They, you know, you see an inside the park home run. The pitchers get the ball, get on the rubber, get the sign, and throw. They're not standing on there worrying about their future lives. They're just getting this guy out. So games are quick. The pace is quick. But we do all the mid-inning stuff. We, you know, we have fireworks on Fridays and Thursdays and all that stuff. We do all of that. It's summer college players, some of them playing with a wood bat for their first time in their lives.
Right. To think of it, it's what minor league baseball was in a lot of places before things kind of blew up and the stadiums got nice and luxury boxes and all that sort of stuff. Like, this is a throwback to your old days back getting started in the game when people can go out and watch a great game and you can get away with a lot of really fun stuff too.
Yeah, and you know what? No major league affiliation. So pretty much, it's your mini major league team.
That's awesome.
And you know what? What I tell the people in Nashua is, you know, guys, this is your team. You know, and Boston has the Red Sox, and Manchester has the Fisher Cats. You guys got the Silver Knights, and we're gonna make you proud of it. And we try to do. Well, we try to treat everybody who walks through that gate. Lauren, you know better than anybody how this works. We try to treat everybody who walks through that gate like their goal.
Yep.
And that's what you can count on coming out here to a Silver Knights game is royal treatment, no pun intended.
Well, we used to, we're with Rick Muntean, the GM of the Nashua Silver Knights. Remember, we used to always talk about it back in Kansas City, treating everybody as if it's their first time there. And
that's right.
And we used to always talk about the second sentence. So I went to the Silver Knights game and saw fireworks. Beers were cheap. But it's always got to be an and that goes along with it. But on the field, who's back from last year's team that fans might recognize?
Well, you know, we had our season ticket holder event here last night, as you witnessed. And when I rattled off a few of these names, they came out of their shoes. So
it was awesome.
Kyle Maurice was one that got a huge round of applause. Tom Blandini, Luke Tyree, Tom Joyce, Teddy Boudreau, Mitch Baker, and then the biggest applause was for this guy, Manny Ray. So, you know, we've got seven real good returners that are going to get their ring on opening night.
It's a lot of fun, and Manny Ray, of course, is a Bedford kid, so we're sitting in Bedford right now. It'll be a name that's familiar to people who are up in our neck of the woods, which obviously not far from you either. So the local names on the team are there. Of course, there's a lot that goes into assembling a team like this.
Yeah, and I'm curious about that. With some guys returning, how do you fill out the roster? What's the process like for recruiting and building your roster?
You know what is really wacky is that the season's not even over yet. You know, it starts literally in the last week of the season where college coaches will call. And in our case, our manager, BJ Neverett, is the one who puts the team together and manages the team. So he's, you know, I like that arrangement. He's in control of his own roster. He picks who he likes. But the New England coaches, and even some from out of state, call with, hey, I've got a shortstop for you for next year. Here's what he does. And so you got to really, at that point, you got to be really knowledgeable about, you know, what you saw last summer, who has good programs, and where some of the high school kids are going. And BJ's on top of all of that. So, yeah, it's not like we're sitting around in a war room saying, okay, well, here's a Levine kid if we want to get. No, basically, it's an assault by the college coaches that that send guys that they want to play for you. So this year we've got six local kids that he signed. Maybe you guys have heard of these guys. Kyle Ball, he's from Exeter, and he goes to Stetson. Cody Morissette, another Exeter kid going to BC. Spencer Bergeron, a pitcher from Nashua, goes to UMass Amherst. And then this kid from Bedford. There's two kids from Bedford. Jeff Masso, going to St. John, so he must be pretty doggone good.
Yeah, he is.
And Grant Levine, who's going to Wake Forest, which he's obviously good. And I guess a couple of those guys might get drafted in the next couple of weeks. So it'll be interesting to see.
It'll be interesting to see. Hanson, you saw Morissette play baseball. We've seen him play basketball.
Yeah, and I didn't see where he was on the field. But his younger brother then came in relief. He's a freshman pitcher who has a pretty good fastball for a freshman. So you might want to keep an eye on him for a few years down the road. And you keep it in the family there.
Yeah, and we've seen Masso go on a number of occasions too. Big, tall lefty, and of course you think St. John's baseball. You think it's a storied program. I mean, Frank Viola and Ron Darling back in that that pitching duel back in the early '80s.
Yeah, they're still talking about that.
It's funny. I saw something on Facebook about it the other day. I think it was like the 27th anniversary of it, something like that. But and then, of course, Levine, the real question with him is, does he get drafted? Does he sign? Who?
Right.
Who knows? So, you know, it'll be interesting. And, of course, fans know those names, which is a good drawing card for you guys.
Definitely. That's certainly, Andrew, that's one of the factors in assembling the ball club is, you got to have host families for the guys from out of town. And it's not an easy thing. Matter of fact, it's probably one of the most difficult phases of the job, is finding and matching players and host families. So the more real local talent you can find, one, it helps sell tickets, but two, it also, alleviates a lot of aggravation in the host family area.
Yeah,
getting local guys is big.
Yeah, that's an interesting dynamic. I stayed with a number of host families throughout my playing days, and I'm still in touch with some of them. And it starts to really build the community with the team, where you have these host families that are season ticket holders and part of the extended family of the Silver Knights, and it helps build, you know, the following, where people can come out, and if they hear a name from last year, they're going to stand up and give the applause, like you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, sometimes you got the bad uncle. And Spiker Helms walked into the office one day. It was the second day of the year up in St. Joe, and he hands me his house key. And he said, I checked into a hotel about 3 a.m. last night when the host family mom and her 14-year-old daughter decided to come into bed with me.
Whoa.
And after he kicked them out, a raccoon fell out of the ceiling onto the bed. I left. Sometimes it doesn't work out, you know?
I was with a family once in the Midwest, and the father of the household was with animal control, and there were a couple of really dangerous dogs living in the house, and he said, you know, don't make eye contact with them, and, you know, don't get in a room alone with them, or they might tear you up.
What?
Yeah. So I stayed there for about three nights, and
15
then
minutes.
Found myself a new residence.
Yeah, you know, and that gentleman, he didn't even know. He had no idea that it would be a problem.
Yeah.
And that's why it's such a difficult dynamic, you know, the pairing people up. And, you know, and we could tell as many stories about, you know, relationships that were started in a host family that last for a lifetime.
Exactly.
So, you know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it is one of the toughest things about the deal.
It's all part of the fun. So thinking about some of that, we were with Rick Muntean, the general manager of the Nashville Silver Knights. You and I have come across some interesting personalities. Of course, Hanson has run across a number as well, because this is baseball. But you've been in the game a long time. Who are some of the crazies or some of the really fun ones that you've run across?
Oh, man, there's millions. Just thinking about one from Kansas City, Andy Shipman. You ever hear of him?
No, oddly enough.
Yeah, right-hand pitcher. He actually, the year 2008, we won the championship. Andy went on quite a heck of a run as our closer at the end of the year. And the one thing that you don't, you take a look at Andy and you'll never realize, but he has a glass eye. And that night after we win the title, we go out to this bar. And, you know, everybody, the interns, the whole team was there. We partied until they kicked us out. But Andy took his eye out and was walking around the room dropping his eyeball in green girls' drink just so we could all watch the reaction. And there's the dude standing there. If you looked at him with his eye out, it looked like you were looking into a black hole.
Right.
You couldn't see anything in there. And the girl goes to take a drink, and there's an eyeball in her drink, and there he is standing there with a big smile on his face. So Andy Shipman, you know, one of the characters that I got to witness over the years. The number one kook is Dave Bresnahan, without a doubt. The number one kook that is responsible for the great potato caper. So that's the number one kook. But I had I had Lance Hudson. I don't know if you remember Lance. He was in the Dodgers system, and I got to see Lance probably like 4 years. And Lance could have been a movie star rather than a baseball player, but the Dodgers loved him as a shortstop. And Lance, he probably had, I don't know, 100 girlfriends. 4 years I got to see him play. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. I had for lack of a better term, he called himself a midget, a 39-inch tall coach by the name of Eddie Morgan in Walla Walla, Washington. And here's one of my favorite Eddie Morgan stories. We didn't have beer to start the season, and the fans kept telling me, come on, can't you get beer at the games? Can't you get beer at the games? Okay, all right. So I worked it out. And I've got a keg in a big, long beer miser, basically, or something that, you know, dispenses beer. And we had to lock the doors at night with a chain and a padlock. Well, the first night, I know we sell like five beers. Come in the next day, keg in. Next night, I'm watching up above, make sure the bartender's not giving out to his buddies. He's not. Come in the next day, keg in. Third day, I count the cups. Cups right on the number. Come in the next day, keg empty. So this night, I decide, well, I'm finding out what's going on. So I literally hid in a bush by the keg. And I'm sitting in this bush waiting for something to happen. And all of a sudden, I hear, yee-haw! And I open the door, and there's Eddie Morgan, our 39-inch coach, with his hand inside of the beer cooler. And he was, since his arm was so small, he was able to reach in and turn the keg on.
Seriously, and he was just drinking straight from the keg.
Yeah, so the guys were standing there drinking till 3 in the morning every night.
Oh, my God.
So, you know, and then you know, the guys in AAA, you know what is really – well, here's a story for you. Gary Alexander in 1992, a guy you probably never heard of him. He was with the Phillies, and in the playoffs in 92, Gary hit 7 home runs and hit .450 in 2 series. So, I mean, he was literally on fire. And he comes to spring training the next year and thinking, okay, this is my shot. He's got, Lauren, Mrs. Fox is gorgeous, but Gary Alexander's wife could have been a model. And he's got 2, like, kids under 4 years old. They stayed in a tent.
Seriously.
In a tent at a campground for spring training because he couldn't afford to stay at the hotel. And don't you know, he gets released at spring training and they have to go home. And,
right.
You know, those stories abound in AAA, you know.
It's a tough game to make it in, for sure. And before we cut you loose, I have 2 more things. First of all, you mentioned the potato story, so now you got to tell it because you met our catcher yesterday, who's on the Nashua PD, and I told him kind of the 30,000-foot view of the story. But I remember seeing it on Good Morning America when I was like 13 or 14.
Honest to God, wow, that's good.
Oh yeah,
yeah, that's part of the story. So, maybe your listeners, I'm sure some of them have heard of Roger Bresnahan. Roger Bresnahan,
the inventor of the shin guard.
Yeah. Hit like .320 in the big leagues, is in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Well, his grandson was a catcher, just like his grandpa, and his name was Dave Bresnahan. And Dave was in the Indian system, and his first 3 years rose right up through the ranks. Hit well, called a great game, threw people out. So now he made it through the bottleneck, and he's in Double A, and that's where I ran into him in Williamsport, Pennsylvania in 1987. The Midwest League All-Star the year before, and he's star opening day starting catcher. Well, now it's about July, Lauren. You know, Williamsport in July is hot and humid, man. And Dave had not thrown out a base stealer all year and was hitting .156 and never playing. And he knew the writing was on the wall, that you know, just like millions of other guys, he hit the wall in Double A and his career was going to end there. And he was never playing. But there's a makeup doubleheader on our schedule on August 26th of that year. And don't you know it, the Philly Fanatic's going to be at the ballpark that night. And Bresnahan knew he was going to catch one of those 2 games. Well, it turns out that he's going to catch his roommate, who was the number 1 pick of the Indians by the name of Mike Pale. So Bresnahan decides that, or actually he read in a book about a high school team in Iowa in the late 30s that threw a potato in a game and the havoc it caused. So he decided he liked it and he wanted to do something similar.
The biggest shock is that he was reading a book.
Well, no, he's a really sharp guy. Anyways, he plays catch. He goes to the grocery store. He tried an onion first. Said it didn't look like a baseball. Peeled a potato, carved it up a little bit, got it to the point where he knew exactly what to do to make it look exactly like a baseball. So here it is, the doubleheader. He's catching the first game, and he knows he's got to have the perfect scenario in order to pull off the trick. So runner on third, less than two outs, right? So guy leads off with a base hit, or actually led off with a double. Now you got a runner on second, nobody out. And then he goes out to the mound. And he said, Mike, I want to get this guy out with sliders. His plan was to have the guy hit a ground ball the right side, move the runner over to third with one out, and now he's set up. Boom, calls the slider. Guy hits the ball to second base, sets up perfectly for him. Now, he's got the potato in his backup mitt in the dugout. He walks out to the mound, and he looks at Pale, and he goes, I'm doing it. And Pale goes, no, you're not. I don't want anything to do with it. Look, all you got to do is throw the pitch I call, right? Right. Just throw the pitch I call. So Bresnahan calls for a pitch out.
Yep.
But on his way back to the dugout, he looks at the umpire and he goes, oh, my mitt's ripped. I got to go get my backup mitt.
Because so why not?
Gets the mitt, got the potato. Nobody other than Pale and the third baseman knew what was going on. Rob Schmid was the third. So Bresnahan goes behind the plate, calls for a pitch out, transfers the potato into his bare hand, catches the ball, stands up, and fires a strike. Swain said it was the best throw he made all year. Fires a strike to third, and Swain lets it go into the outfield. Well, of course, everybody, including me, looks out there and says, oh, well, great, Brez. What they're, you know, the, here we go.
Right, you had one job to do, yeah.
And Rick Lemblade's on third. He races home, and Bresnahan's at the plate, has the ball in his hand, tags him, and the umpire calls him out.
while the potato's rolling down the left field line.
Yeah, and left fielder and shortstop are chasing the potato, I'm sure.
Well, the left fielder, Miguel Roman, gets over to it. The fans are screaming, pick it up, pick it up. And he stands there with his hands on his head. And finally, and Bill Dancy, who was coaching third, races into the umpire, screaming. He had two balls in the game. And then Miguel brings in the potato that was in three pieces. And we sent it to the Hall of Fame the next day. So the umpire, Scott Potter, calls the runner safe, throws Bresnahan out of the game, and when he gets back to the dugout, Orlando Gomez, our manager, who's like human because he didn't know,
right,
says, you're fined $50, get in the clubhouse. So after the game, Bresnahan got released by the Indians. And the next day, I'm happening to stand there watching the cleanup crew, and Bresnahan walks in with a brown paper sack. Brez, what's up? He goes, well, I got released after the game last night. I go, why? He goes, well, the potato. Oh, okay. So he goes, I got to go and clean my locker out. He goes in there and puts the potato, one potato in everybody's locker, and piled 50 on Orlando's desk and tacked a note. Dear Orlando, surely you don't expect me to pay the $50 fine now that I've been released. Instead, here's 50 potatoes. This bud's for you, Dave Bresnahan.
Amazing.
And now the epilogue is this, that everybody in town played baseball in Waynesport. It's the home of Little League baseball. Everybody played. The next day, they hated Bresnahan for making a travesty of the game. I can still hear it.
Blah, blah, blah.
Then he was on Jay Leno. Then he was on David Letterman. Then he was on the show you saw. Then he was on the baseball game of the week. And on Monday night, Lo, he was on the college football game on Memorial Weekend. But when he was on Paul Harvey on Tuesday, that was it.
Yeah.
Yes, that was it. They called me. He's our guy. We love him. Bring him back.
That didn't take long.
And to finish it off, the next year we brought him back on Memorial Day, retired his number. It was the biggest crowd in Williamsport baseball history. You got in with a buck and a potato. And we had to clean out the box office twice because there was somebody.
See, that's the best part, though. Like, and that's the minor league baseball aspect of it is, okay, the story happens, but then how do you continue to give it life the next year? And it's something clever and fun where it's a buck and a potato to get into the game. Like, that's what I love about minor league baseball. That's the
Here's
fun stuff you get to do.
Here's what people don't know is Dave was so nervous when we retired his number. He was so it was comical. He was shaking so much that he drank a case of Rolling Rock before he went out on the field. And I got to tell you, I thought for sure I was going to have to hold him up for his speech, but he gathered it together, and it was fantastic.
Amazing,
fantastic.
Amazing,
yeah, it was really good.
So one more thing before we let you go, you're hosting the Futures League All-Star Game this year.
Yes.
And I know you and I talked about it yesterday with Mike Welch, who pitched for you in Scranton back in the day and pitched in the majors back in the late 90s. But what are you planning on doing for that?
Well, Lauren, it's the 80th anniversary of Holman Stadium, which is, you know, got to be one of the oldest in all of baseball. We're going to bring back some of the luminaries that actually played on this field. And right now, thank you for being involved in this. The Nashua Dodgers were the first integrated minor league baseball team. Branch Rickey placed a couple players here back in 1946. Roy Campanella, who has passed, and Don Newcomb, who is still alive and kicking, I believe, out in L.A.
Yeah, he's still out there. I know from talking to somebody with the Dodgers, he's having a hard time getting around these days. And doesn't travel much, but that being said, hey, you never know.
Yeah, and, you know, we've reached out in a variety of ways to Mr. Newcomb, but no matter what, if he shows up or not, I'll get a letter from him, because I'm sure that he and Campanella were warmly received here and had a fantastic summer. But one team is going to wear number 39 for Campy. It'll be the Dodgers Road, and the Dodgers Home will wear number 36 for Don Duke. So kind of like a takeoff of the Jackie Robinson deal. But we're going to have, you know, Greg Landry, a quarterback with the Detroit Lions, is from Nashua, played on Holman Stadium. Glenn Murray, who played for the Red Sox, played at Holman. Ruben Rodriguez, a Pirates guy. So, you know, we're reaching out to some of the bands that played here. Aerosmith, Steven Tyler, families from Nashua. Boston played here. Tina Turner played here. So, and a lot of football players play here. So we're reaching out to a lot of the people that, you know, to come on back, wave to the crowd. The city has purchased every ticket. So
wow.
If you're from Nashua, you get in free. And it's going to be an all-day event starting with the showcase at 10 in the morning, then a concert in the middle of the day in the afternoon. We're working on some name. The Beach Boys played here. I've reached out to them, so we'll see, maybe. And then Home Run Derby, and then the All-Star Game with a fireworks show after. It is going to be a fabulous night.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. I remember what we did back in, was that 05 or 06 in Kansas City, when we had Willie Wilson, Amos Otis, Fergie Jenkins.
Vida Blue. Ozzie Smith.
So, yeah, that was the Buck O'Neill year, yes.
Yep. That was 1996 or 2006.
2006, yeah. That was a good
2006. Here's the one thing I want to tell you about that night, and you know it. I've told it a million times. The post-game party
over there
at Dave & Buster's.
Oh, yeah.
On a patio. I have $2,000 worth of food there, appetizers and stuff. I got Miller Lite to donate all the beer for free. When I got the bill, it was for $16,000. What in the world was $14,000? $14,000 of shot.
I was going to say, I have merely vague recollections of that night. My main recollection is of going to the stadium the next day and how bright it was outside. Actually, no, I do remember talking to George Brett after that game. But, yeah. We had a good crew. So, anyway,
that was a spectacular event.
That was fun. Is the Futures League All Star Game? Is that your birthday?
Yes, sir.
That's why is the All Star Game always on your birthday?
I don't know, bud. I mean, my birthday's in prime All Star area.
It's hey.
That's probably this is at least my fifth, sixth All Star game with being on my birthday. So
hey.
Hey, you know what? It works.
It works. So, well, Rick Muntine, we appreciate the time, and I will see you soon. Look forward to catching up.
Thanks a lot, man. It was my pleasure.
All right, buddy.
Good luck.
That was Rick Muntean, the general manager of the Nashua Silver Knights, who open up their season next Friday, June 1st, down at historic Holman Stadium. We'll be back after this. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen, and we are joined by our good friend of the program, Ryan O'Connor, who is the resident NH sports guy, who is our eyes and ears places that we cannot be. So, Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hey, guys. Good to be back.
Awesome. Well, we're in the thick of a variety of different spring playoffs. Things are coming. I can't even say that word without thinking of Jim Mora.
Playoffs.
Sorry. So, but baseball is about to get into the thick of things, but you were there the other day when, surprisingly enough, Bedford, which had been undefeated through the season, lost 3-2 to Pinkerton.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's kind of cool. Well, it's not cool for Bedford fans, but an interesting thing that I sort of noticed over the last couple weeks is two different Pinkerton teams ended Bedford team's winning streak. So,
yep.
Of course, Bedford's tennis team, which had won 111 straight matches, lost to Pinkerton about a week and a half ago, is last Wednesday. And then, of course, Pinkerton this week, literally a week later, ends Bedford's bid at an undefeated season. So they've been a little bit of a thorn in Bedford's side, but the cool thing about it is that both teams kind of now Pinkerton is the team with the target on their back from Bedford, and that's probably someplace they don't want to be because Bedford certainly has two juggernauts there. But yeah, I mean, Bedford, they fell in the baseball game. I know it was a tough game. It was senior day. And so I know Bedford really wanted to win that game. But of course, like most other Bedford teams, their ultimate goal is a championship. And so their attitude kind of coming out of that is like, okay, you know, we dropped this one. We're just going to be that much better in the playoffs.
And lots of times with baseball, you come across a hot pitcher, you can have an off day at the plate, and Bedford has just had an outstanding season. So I'm guessing there's no real cause for concern. And in fact, sometimes when you lose once, you know, you feel that you're not invincible, and it really gets you motivated for the playoffs. But what do you think about their run heading into the playoffs? Any causes for concern?
No, none at all. I mean, the formula that Pinkerton used is kind of that tried and true cliche baseball formula: pitching and defense wins games, right? You know, so if you look at that game, Pinkerton limited Bedford to three hits, while Pinkerton had six hits and ended up getting in for three runs. But the big thing there was Bedford also had three errors and Pinkerton had none. So, you know, it's pretty simple when you look at that, box score to kind of figure out what happened there, especially because Pinkerton's closer was able to come in and strike out the side for Bedford. So it's like, you know, going into that last inning, it was a pretty even game. And Pinkerton was able to get two runs in the seventh inning and then have their closer come in and just completely shut them down. So the trick for Bedford in the playoffs is just to get back to doing what they do, you know, which is just play clean baseball, good pitching, and obviously just get those situational hits. They did a good job late in the game of, you know, they got two runs in the sixth inning to take the lead because they were down 1-0. And then unfortunately, you know, they lost it in the seventh. And so, again, you know, going back to Pinkerton though, one thing that Coach Chapman said to me after the game was that the way that Pinkerton celebrated was like that they just won a championship. And Bedford's going to remember that. The players all saw that. And he said, you know, we're going to put that in our back pocket. And I think they're planning on seeing them again. And again, I wouldn't want to be Pinkerton with a rabid Bulldogs team kind of staring at you going into probably it would be, I think Pinkerton is the third seed in the playoffs. I think they're going to be the third seed. So it would probably be in the championship game if they do see each other again.
Yeah, no doubt Coach Chapman will have his guys use that as motivation. And then in terms of the X's and O's, he'll also, you know, talk about those errors and have the guys refocus on defense and get ready to play clean games throughout the playoffs. We are joined here by Ryan O'Connor, And Ryan, you mentioned the tennis teams, and as we tape the show on Friday morning, the boys team is set to play in the state championship, and the girls team is currently in the semifinal round. What do you think of their chances to finish it off and capture state championships?
I mean, they're always the favorite, right? It's Bedford's just such an amazing tennis town. You know, you can call it what you will, whether it's just, you know, money for those private lessons or just great coaching or a combination of all the above. But Bedford just, on both teams, they're just perennial championship contenders. And, of course, Bedford's going for, I think it's ninth straight in boys tennis. They've lost literally one time, which was last week, in the last 5 years. I think their last, or maybe even longer than that, I think their last loss was in 2010. And so it's been a long time, and they, you know, they're just as good as they always are. The thing that I've always said about both Bedford tennis teams is you could probably, you know, you've got your ladder of your top six players that compete, but you could probably take their 7 through 12 players and put them, you know, on any other team, and they would be competitive for a state championship. And so it's depth. And the interesting thing about Bedford's team this year, as opposed to years past, is typically where Bedford, and when I say struggle, they very rarely struggle, but where they've sort of been susceptible is kind of at the top of the ladder, especially for the boys team, because you end up any school, whether it be Londonderry, Derryfield, they can have one or two real standout players that can compete, you know, with the best that Bedford has. But it's that depth that Bedford has, you know, getting down to that 3, 4, 5, 6 slot, and then of course getting into doubles action, where Bedford usually just, you know, mops the floor with other teams. And this year, Bedford's top two have just, you know, they've been lights out, but Bedford's been a little more beatable, especially in that Pinkerton matchup, and even yesterday in their playoff matchup where they did drop some of those 3, 4, 5, 6 games. And so it's going to be really interesting because they do have a rematch with Pinkerton now set up for next Tuesday to see how that plays out, because that was an area that Pinkerton was able to exploit. And of course it was 5-4. And so a couple of those matches were really close and they could have gone either way. And so I think, you know, Bedford going in still feels pretty good about their chances, but it is a little bit of an interesting dynamic compared to years past.
Yeah, that depth can be really powerful in many ways. And we're talking with Ryan O'Connor. And of course, last week you had an article in the Bedford Bulletin about the boys lacrosse team here in Bedford. And right after your piece, they'd won 3 in a row. Then they went up against BG, a perennial power in lacrosse, and they lost 15-6. But then they won 3 in a row since then. What have you found and what have you learned about the way that the boys lacrosse team has been coming together this season?
Yeah, it's got to be so frustrating on some levels for those guys because they're so good. You know, I mean, they send usually like a half dozen guys to college on scholarships a year. They constantly have All-Americans each and every year. They've got great defenders, great goaltending, certainly great scoring. That's typically their bread and butter, is just, you know, just absolutely outscoring other teams. But the problem in New Hampshire is you've always got BG and Pinkerton. And there's, you talk about powerhouses. I mean, those teams are, I don't want to call them national powerhouses, but certainly regional powerhouses. And when you look at Bedford's losses, it's, they lost twice to Exeter, they lost once to Pinkerton, they lost once to BG, and they lost a couple times to really strong Massachusetts programs. And so, you know, you're talking about a team that, you know, is probably an elite team by any other standard, except when you're looking at those top two teams in the division. So it's one of those things where I personally feel, you know, with all the talent Bedford has, you know, they really need to almost have their best day and play not necessarily error-free, but pretty clean lacrosse. And they need the other team to sort of stumble a bit. And they certainly have the ability to capitalize if that happens. They were beating Pinkerton, I think, in the first game that they played them back in April. I think they were beating them I don't remember what the score was at halftime, but they were definitely beating them. And they came out in the second half and they had some bad penalties and some bad turnovers, and against a team like Pinkerton, you just can't get away with that. And of course, Pinkerton capitalized and then just kind of ran away with it. So the key for them is just, very similar to the baseball team. They just got to go out there and they just got to play their game. They got to play clean and they got to hope that the other team makes a mistake or two and that they're prepared to take advantage of it.
Yeah. On the flip side, I watched some of the second half of the game against BG. that was televised on BCTV, and they outscored BG in the fourth quarter, so that was nice to see that strong finish. What about the girls? They're 14-3, all three of their losses only by 1 point. What do you make of their chances in the tournament?
Yeah, and if you want to go back even further, they lost in the championship game last year. I think it was 10-9 to Sauhegan by 1 point. So, you know, this is a team that's clearly right there. They're the team that I am 100% sure no other team in the state wants to face in the tournament, because they're hungry, they're competitive, and they're constantly one goal away. And so, you know, you just kind of get that feeling that maybe this is the year. Maybe this is the year that, because they have a Division II championship, they don't have a Division I championship yet. And so, you know, maybe this is the year that they finally get over that hump and score that one extra goal or those two extra goals against one of their, you know, top competitors like Sauhegan. And maybe that's it, because the three games that they've lost, I think it was Sauhegan, I can't remember who the second one was, and then they lost to Winneconnet, who's just a Division II beast and could probably compete with anybody, as they showed against Bedford in Division I. And so Bedford's as much in the mix as anybody else, and I just feel like they may want it more this year. And so my prediction going in is this is going to be the year for Bedford girls lacrosse.
It is always great to talk to you, Ryan. Your knowledge of New Hampshire high school sports, and specifically in our case, the Bedford stuff, is it's amazing. It's impressive, and it's a lot of fun to have you on and hear about it.
Yeah, absolutely, guys. My pleasure. I get a little geeked out by it, especially come playoff time.
I love
covering these teams, love writing about them, and certainly enjoy talking to you guys about it.
Wonderful. Well, Ryan O'Connor, thanks for the time. Also, quickly wanted to thank our other guest, Rick Muntean, the general manager of the Nashua Silver Knights, and thank the fine folks here at Bedford 105.1, Bill, Chris, Harry, and Colleen, for letting us sit in here for the hour that we've been able to record the studio. So for Andrew Hansen, I'm Lauren Fox. Thank you. We will catch you next week. You've been listening to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1.